Hello and welcome to Your Homegrown Food. I'm your host, Jonna, and this is a show about all things food. So, last week on this show, I played a talk by Eric Holt Jimenez. It was the first half of his talk. He is an agroecologist and political economist. He is also the executive director of Food First Institute for Food and Development Policy, and he's the author of the Food First book, Food Rebellions, Crisis and the Hunger for Justice. So today I'm going to play the second half of his talk. Let's see. Let me get it queued up here, and we will listen to Eric Holt Jimenez talk about global food sovereignty.
America in foreign aid. So, wouldn't it have been better just to let them produce their own food? Here in the United States, something like 1.3 million Mexican campesinos and campesinas, smallholders, farmers, went bankrupt as a result of NAFTA. And we got millions of immigrants coming into the United States. The other day I was talking to a farmer in California, and he was lamenting the fact that he was getting old. And he said, there's no farmers to take over the land anymore. My kids don't want to work anymore. What are we going to do? There's no more farmers. And I felt sorry for him. I felt sorry that the kids didn't want to take over the land. I knew why. They couldn't make a good living at it. But he didn't look around him. If he'd looked at his workers, they were Mexican farmers before they came to be his workers. If he looked at the restaurant chefs, they were all Mexican farmers before they came up here to work for a lousy wage. There are farmers all over this country. You just got to open your eyes and find them. They're there. And there are millions of young people who would love to get into farming. They're all there. I should say that the Green Revolution, aside from allowing the agribusiness to expand over the rest of the world, that it was very lucrative for the U.S. I mean, it was sold as a way of solving the problems of hunger around the world. We need them better seeds, they're going to raise more food, and we're going to solve hunger. In fact, Norman Borlaug got the Nobel Prize because they said he saved 1 billion people from starvation. In fact, in the U.S., corn and soy production, the seed companies benefited by about $10 billion a year by stealing the seeds from the Global South, patenting them as hybrids, and then selling them back to the rest of the world. The farmers who for 6 millennia have developed those seeds never saw a penny. And then, of course, we have the rise of the giant monopolies, the oligopolies, ADM, Cargill, and Bunge, that now control 80% of the world's grain. Monsanto, that controls a fifth of the world's seeds. And who laugh at antitrust laws. Fining them $100 million is just the cost of doing business. What this all boils down to is what I call the corporate food regime. This concept was advanced by a researcher named Harriet Friedman from the University of Toronto, who helped to start the Toronto Food Policy Council. Something else I'm going to talk about. But she basically says that a food regime is a rule-governed structure of production and consumption of food on a world scale. And she looks at this historically to see that we've gone through a couple of different food regimes. And then Phil McMichael from Cornell University says that today what we have is the corporate food regime, which is based on fossil fuels, dominated by the global monopolies, and characterized, among other things, by the supermarket revolution and what are called global animal protein chains and genetically modified seeds. And they're controlled by the industrial agri-foods complex. The regime is controlled by the industrial agri-foods complex, the big monopolies. With the help of the World Bank, the IMF, the USDA, USAID, the World Food Program, and now big philanthropy. These are the institutions of the food regime that make the rules that govern our food. Now, food regime, how does one manage a food regime like this? And to understand it, I think we have to recognize first, this is a capitalist food regime. So then we have to look at what are the different phases that capitalism goes through. And Karl Polanyi, who was one of the great thinkers and students of capitalism, who studied capitalism and how it worked, who followed Karl Marx and others, and followed David Ricardo, and followed Adam Smith, who were all trying to understand capitalism. Karl Polanyi said that, in fact, capitalism always goes through two different periods, if you look through history. It goes through what's called a liberalization period, which is characterized by unregulated markets and sort of breathtaking capital expansion, followed by devastating busts. And then it has to go through a reformist period, in which markets, supply, and consumption are all regulated in an effort to restabilize the regime. And it goes back and forth. Liberalization, reform, liberalization, reform. So, if you look at the 1929 crash and depression, that was following a period of liberalization. Then we get the crash. Then we get the New Deal, and we have a whole period of reform. And then Margaret Thatcher and Ronald Reagan get into office, and we move very quickly into another period of liberalization, which we call neoliberalization now. And that's where we are. We're in a period of intense neoliberalization. And that's the same is true for the corporate food regime. The corporate food regime has gone through phases of liberalization and reform. And it's in a period of neoliberalization now. And I've already named all of their main institutions. Right? Their orientation is corporate. The discourse is food enterprise. And their approach to the food crisis is very telling. The food crisis hits. We know why it hits. And they say, we can solve it. The architects of the food crisis, in other words, it's like calling an arsonist to put out the fire. The arsonists come and say, we can put out the fire. We're going to put it out with more liberalization, more free markets, fewer grain reserves, and more technology. Another green revolution. This one based on genetically modified organisms. And they have a guiding document. It's the World Bank's 2008 Development Report on Agriculture. The bank hadn't spoken a word about agriculture for over 20 years. They'd ignored agriculture. But that's their guiding report now. There's also a reformist current, if not a full-fledged trend, within the food regime. It's always there. It's just that at any given time, either the neoliberal trend will be dominant or the reformist trend will be dominant, just like capitalism. The reformist trend, I have to say, is just as meek and weak in the food regime as it is in our government in general. You see, the difficulty of the Obama administration to keep from falling into Afghanistan, the difficulty of the Obama administration in attempting to extricate itself from Iraq, the difficulty that Obama has in passing the meekest of healthcare reform programs, and you realize that the reformists are not very strong within capitalism, and they're not very strong within the food regime. The reformists in the food regime talk about mainstreaming the good things that we like, like fair trade coffee, organic agriculture, finding ways so that the corporate agri-food system can incorporate some of these good things, reforming them a bit, not doing away with them, not putting something separate in their place, but trying to make them a little nicer. They also depend on the World Development Report for agriculture. And their approach to the food crisis was basically the same, except they said, well, we need more safety nets and we need more food aid. Right? And we need a little bit more flexibility in letting countries protect their agriculture. But that was it. They weren't really interested in changing things. So I probably got you all depressed. Depresses me. Depresses the hell out of me. I just study this stuff every day. And have to write about it. And then sleep well at night so I can go at it again the next day. The good news is that in response to the corporate food regime, we have the rise of the food movements. And then we have the rise of food movements around the world. And you know what I'm talking about. The CSAs, the farmers markets, the local food policy councils, the MST, the Landless Workers Movement in Brazil, the Via Campesina, which is the peasant International Peasant Federation, right? Movements all over Europe trying to, let's call it breaking through the asphalt, trying to green urban areas with food. Reflected in the price of the product. These things are happening all over the world. Literally thousands and thousands of organizations working on these issues. And millions of people. Sustainable agriculture, organic agriculture. There was a study done not long ago by the University of Michigan which asked the question, can sustainable agriculture feed the world? And they looked at studies all over the world comparing sustainable to conventional agriculture. And what they came up with was several scenarios, low, medium, and high production scenarios. And every single one of those scenarios, the answer was yes. We don't need industrial agriculture to feed us. We can feed ourselves perfectly well with organic and more agroecological and sustainable approaches. In fact, we can feed a population of up to 10 billion people. There's not a problem of technology. It's a problem of distribution. It's a problem of control over the food system itself. I don't get to show you the pretty slides, I guess. Now, I want to talk to you as activists. I'm sure many of you are involved in this type of work. That's probably why you came to this talk. And I want to talk to you as people from the United States, or people who live in the United States, primarily. And I want us to take a closer look at our food movement. Because I think that we have two trends. Just as the corporate food regime has two trends, I think that the food movement has two trends. And I think one trend I would call the transitional trend. And these are the folks who care about sustainability and food justice, empowerment. These are the alternative fair trade and some slow food chapters. The community food security movement, a lot of the CSAs, the food policy councils, a lot of the youth food and justice organizations, some of the farm and labor organizations. And they're all about, let's have good, healthy, agroecologically produced food. Let's go local. Let's have more control over our food system. Let's turn food systems in the inner cities into engines for local economic growth. They're about the right to food, about better food safety, better safety nets. Then I'd say there's another trend, which is not as strong in our country, not as strong in the United States, but much stronger globally. And that's the transformational trend. And this is the trend within the food movements for food sovereignty. Food sovereignty is the concept, the political concept and the platform advanced by Via Campesina some 13 years ago. And basically, food sovereignty is people's right to healthy and culturally appropriate food produced through ecologically sound and sustainable methods and the right to define their own food and agriculture systems. I think it's very important to know where this definition came from. This definition came from the peasants in the Peasant Federation, Via Campesina. There's about a billion peasants in the world. They produce over half of the world's food. If you expect to solve the food crisis in any way, you've got to deal with them. And what they're saying is, we want to be able to define our own food and agricultural systems. So essentially, food sovereignty is about the democratization of the food system in favor of the poor. The Catholic Church at one time in the 1970s took a preferential option for the poor. And I think this is something very similar to that, with liberation theology and whatnot. This is about taking a preferential option for the poor because, in fact, they are the majority. Over half of the people in the world are poor. And nearly half of them are hungry. And some 36 to 50 million of them are here in the United States, living in underserved communities, in the inner cities, and in the great food desert we call the Midwest, where people are dying of diabetes, heart disease, because of the lousy food they're forced to eat. And yet they produce our food. They're in the processing plants, they're in the fields, they're in restaurants, and they're dying. So, food sovereignty, this act of democratizing the food system, putting it back into citizens' hands in favor of the poor, is really a revolutionary concept. It's radical democracy. Radical democracy very much at the root of our own social, cultural, and metabolic processes. And I think that a food sovereignty regime is possible. We can rebuild smallholder and family agriculture. We can get agriculture out of the WTO. We can renegotiate the free trade agreements. We can put a moratorium on agrofuels. We can rebuild our national food systems around the world. We can rebuild local food systems by re-regulating trade and finance, by supporting farmers' movements and consumers' movements and community food security movements, by supporting agroecological approaches to production, reestablishing our grain reserves, protecting local seeds, and allowing farmers to own their own seeds. I think there's a challenge, I think there's a danger within our food movements. Because I think that in the United States, most of us fall into the category of the transitional movements. We're dealing with the problems of food on a very immediate basis, in the neighborhood. How do we get good food into the neighborhood? With all these food deserts, which people can now call food apartheid. Because you can't find fresh food. All you find is convenience stores. You can't even find a Safeway in West Oakland, where we're from. So people are dealing with, how do we get grocery stores? How do we get community gardens? How do we do these things immediately? Farmers are dealing with the same things. You know, how do I wean myself away from pesticides, fertilizers? How can I save my own seed? How can I get my own seed from being contaminated by Monsanto seed and then getting sued by them for stealing their genetic material? These are very immediate problems within the transitional movement that people are dealing with. But we don't tend to deal with the structural issues that the transformational sector trend deals with. Land reform. How do we get the farmers back on the land? Get them out of the restaurants and onto the land. How do we redistribute land? Get it away from the large plantations. How do we stop the land grabs, the northern countries buying up land in the global south for agrofuels? How do we get agriculture out of the WTO? How do we change the US Farm Bill, which is really a farm and food bill? In fact, more money in the Farm Bill goes towards consumption issues instead of production issues. It's really a food bill. We should all be voting on it. We should all be pressuring our urban legislators to weigh in on the Farm Bill. These are the structural issues, the more transformational issues. These are the ones which take the corporate food regime on at its very rules and institutions. Whereas the transitional movement, where most of us work, I would say, is just dealing with getting by day to day and getting some fresh food into the community, healthy food. That transitional trend, I would submit to you, if it aligns itself with the reformist trend within the corporate food regime, it will only serve to reinforce the corporate food regime. If it allies itself, on the other hand, with the transformational trends at home and abroad, then I think we have a chance of transforming the corporate food regime. And why do I say this? If you look back in the 1930s after the crash, and you look at the New Deal, do you think the New Deal came about just because of Roosevelt's largesse? Because of his wisdom, his vision? I mean, he had all that, but that's not why it came about. I consider Obama to be a man of wisdom and vision, and yet he can't get the most minimal reforms out the door. It's because back in the 30s, there was a strong transformational movement, a strong labor movement, which scared capitalism half to death, because they were afraid they were going to get pulled down by workers. And it was that strength, the strength in union power, community power, the Grange, I mean, that is what forced capitalism to reform. I don't think we can rely on the wisdom of the neoliberal or the liberal trends within capital to reform capitalism. They'll go right on making profits until they destroy the social and environmental basis of capitalism. But I don't think that the reformist sectors today are strong enough to do anything. So where is this going to come from? Who's going to lead the political change? Who's going to apply the pressure for that type of change? I don't think it comes from the reformist sectors. I think it comes from the transformational sectors. And I think that those of us who work in transition and work in our communities and want to have to be looking at and aligning with those forces of transformation if we really want to put the pressure on the food regime. Now, I think we have to realize that there are some systemic divergences in our food movement. This isn't our fault. This is a historical reflection of how things are. So you have, for example, a lot of people who work on food security. You know, food banks, for example. Food aid, whatnot. Good folks, good work. But they're not talking with the people who are working on structural change. And in fact, sometimes are at direct odds with them. So, if the National Family Farm Coalition in the U.S. says, we don't want any more subsidies, what we want is a fair price because we're tired of overproducing. But you have the food banks saying, yeah, but we get the surplus from the government to put in our food banks. So don't stop overproducing. These are both good folks. These are both excellent organizations. But there's a divergence there, which has to be addressed and overcome if we're going to be strong. But that divergence between the underserved and the overserved. I had breakfast this morning in a beautiful farmer's market over here. Fairly cheap. Good cup of coffee and a fruit crepe. I don't know, it came in under $10 or something. That's still too much for somebody, for the people standing out in front of Safeway, spare changing. That's still too much for families with single parents living in the inner city. Those are the underserved. If we're going to have healthy food, it has to be healthy food for everybody. The overserved who can afford to go to the food, slow food convivia or presidium and drop down $100, $150 for a meal and enjoy the pleasure of good, locally produced food. That's great. We should all enjoy the pleasure of good, healthy, locally produced food. But that means that the underserved, the workers in Walmart, also have to have access to that good food. So we have to figure out how to bring together the underserved and the overserved. I also think we have to figure out how to bring together the advocates and the practitioners. I spent the night last night with comrades here, and one of them works a farm. It was a collective, a farm collective. They have 5 acres, I think, and we ate some grapes, fresh food from the farm. And that takes up all of her time, working on that farm. She's a practitioner. It's all organic. It's great stuff. We need them. But she's separated from the advocates in the National Family Farm Coalition who are walking the Capitol Hill, busting down the doors of the congressmen, demanding structural change for farmers. I worked with the farmers' movement for 20 years in Latin America. Fantastic farmers. They basically established sustainable agriculture in Mesoamerica, all by themselves. No help from the state, no help from professionals. They did it. They're completely organic. Their yields are 3 and 4 times what everybody else's is. When a big hurricane came through, Hurricane Mitch, back in 98, they withstood the hurricane, no problem. Their fields are much more resilient to these type of climate hazards than all the conventional farmers. They're great practitioners, but they're not advocates. And they're being destroyed by NAFTA because they can't get a price for their corn. Via Campesina and UNORCA and other organizations in Central America do the advocacy, but they've got to come together. And finally, I think that, I don't know how many of you work in the food movement or militate in the food movement. Brothers and sisters, there's a big, gaping hole in our food movement. And that's the labor question. So it's great to establish grocery stores in inner city neighborhoods. It's great to go organic. It's great to do all those things, but we're never going to change the food system until we work with the workers at Walmart, Safeway, the workers in the fields, the workers in all the packing plants across this country, in the Midwest. We won't have the political force to change anything unless we somehow reach out to labor and look at labor in the food system and the way it is now and what it could be. They're among the worst paid workers in the United States. They have some of the worst health problems, diet-related health problems in the United States. And until we form a strong alliance between the food movement, which tends to be now about putting in CSAs and grocery stores and this and that, but until we ally with the workers, I really don't think we can go up against the corporate food regime. The good news is that there's growing convergence in spite of the systemic divergence. Both nationally and internationally, we're beginning to see where all these different sectors within the food movement are beginning to converge. You see it in Via Campesina, you see it in the World Social Forums. We had one here in Atlanta. They're held all around the world. We had one in Atlanta. You see it in the International Links Committee for Food Sovereignty. You see it in the Community Food Security Coalition here in the United States. The human right to food has been championed by the UN Special Rapporteur on the right to food. And that call, the right to food, is being taken up all over the world and here in the United States. There's a new group called the Working Group on the Food Crisis, the U.S. Working Group on the Food Crisis, in which all these different sectors, workers, farmers, farm workers, community rights activists, food justice people, huge representation from youth, tremendous dynamism, coming together and launch a food crisis campaign, ending food. And you know what it's about? It's about rebuilding our communities with the food system. Because when we all came together, those people came together, people were talking about, yes, it should be about sustainable agriculture, yes, it should be about the right to food. And the majority of the people there, who were poor folks, said, we need jobs. We need to make the food system into an engine for local economic growth. Otherwise, don't talk to me about going to a farmer's market. I gotta get the food where I can get it. I don't think there's a contradiction there. I think we can demand that the food system work for us at the local level. We're forming food policy councils. And these food policy councils, sure, you can't affect the farm bill, but you can affect what your city does or what your county does. And you can create a policy environment which favors the localization of food, which favors getting good food into the schools and into the underserved communities, and providing jobs and processing, production, and distribution in these communities. We see advocates and practitioners coming together in these food policy councils. And we do see the underserved and the overserved beginning to talk to each other. I just came back from Italy. I was invited by Slow Food. And I was, on one hand, very taken aback because everybody who came to the conference had to pay their own way. They each had to pay 2,000 euros. They drove up in Lamborghinis and BMWs. And, I'm not kidding, a Rolls Royce. What am I going to say to these comrades, you know? And I said, thank you for reaching out to poor farmers and helping poor farmers so they can produce good, healthy food. Now you need to do something else. Now you need to work with poor consumers. Otherwise, we're not going to be able to change this thing. And they said yes. There's a young man who runs Slow Food USA, Josh Vertel. He's a food justice advocate. There was an incident in Detroit some time back. Underserved community, African-American community, they decided they didn't want any more fast food joints in their community because the food is killing them. But they didn't know how to stop it. They aligned with a Slow Food group in Detroit. These are the people, socially mobile. They know the people on the council. They know the politicians. They know the different business people. They have time. They can organize, and they formed an alliance, and they helped the folks in that community kick the fast food out. These are the types of alliances that are happening now. This is the growing convergence and diversity which we're beginning to see in the food movement. And I think that's the key. I think we have to look for convergence in our diversity and diversity in our convergence, and I think we can change this thing. Thank you.
101 FM.
101 FM.
101 FM.
101 FM.